From Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in our La Crosse studios. Coming up later on today's show, find out what's going on this spring at the National Eagle Center in Wabasha, Minnesota. But first, Sister Thea Bowman. It's a name very familiar to many of you. The Canton, Mississippi native came to La Crosse in the 50s to join the Franciscan Sisters of Perpetual Adoration. The granddaughter of an enslaved person, Sister Thea eventually became one of the leading voices for Black Catholicism in America. On Newsmakers today, we'll hear about a new center named in her honor, and we'll find out how they hope to carry forth her legacy. We're going to learn all about a one-woman musical, too, all about Sister Thea, and hear from the actor that is portraying her. Joining us, speaking of that very actor, joining us are Valimar Jansen, singer, composer, performing and recording artist, and the creative force behind a musical that we'll hear about shortly. Valimar, thank you very much for joining us on Newsmakers.
So great to be with you. Thank you for having me today.
Of course. Also joining us today, Sister Laura Nettles. Sister Laura is the Executive Director for Mission and Social Justice and Assistant Professor of Religious Studies at Viterbo University. Sister Laura, thank you for your time today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Let's start with you, Sister Laura. There are many events going on. This have been going on all week regarding Sister Thea Bowman and especially the launch of the brand new Sister Thea Bowman Center at Viterbo University. Tell me about this new center.
Well, we have been wanting to do something in Thea's honor for quite a while on our campus, and we've talked about it for I can't tell you how many years. And the stars aligned in a perfect way for us to be able to start this new center with the help of a lot of sponsors, of course. The center is really aimed at not only celebrating the life and legacy of Thea, but doing the work of social justice that was near and dear to her heart. So it's really important for us that the center is about her life lived out today.
And the center, when you were talking about universities, different ideas come to mind. So not only is this a center in the academic sense, but it is an actual physical space, right?
Correct. We have our campus ministry building is what we have formerly called it. And it's going to be named in her honor on Wednesday. We're going to have an unveiling of the signs on Wednesday.
And so it's a familiar space to many on campus, and now will be named in honor of Sister Thea Bowman. And speaking of honoring Sister Thea, there's a new one-woman musical, Sister Thea Bowman, I Will Live Until I Die. And the performer and compiler of all kinds of information and basically writer of that musical is with us today, Valimar Jansen. Valimar, tell me about portraying someone like Sister Thea. What does it take to get in that creative space?
Well, it actually took some pushing from different people because she was such a force within our own Black Catholic community, as well as just in general. If anyone who's ever been to a youth conference or any kind of catechetical conference or liturgical conference that has ever seen her, you will never, ever forget that experience. You will always hold on to that experience of actually having seen her present. And she presented at conferences throughout the United States and abroad when she was in the heyday of the ministry that God entrusted to her. And so what it took for me was a lot of people saying, you know, you remind me of someone. So after about the 10th person said that to me, you remind me of someone. And I say, who's that? Sister Thea Bowman, just your energy. I started reading about her and finding out more about her because I'm like Sister Thea. I'm a convert to Catholicism, and so was she. And so I immediately just brought her into my heart, that number one. But then the more I read about her, the more I learned about her, the more I heard from colleagues as I traveled the U.S., and I would learn more about her by people who had inexperience of being with her. So that's what inspired me to write this musical. And one of the things that she said that really stuck with me is that I will live until I die. And she said that after she found out she was diagnosed with cancer. And you know, in the throes of cancer and the treatment, she said, if I truly live, and that's to live every moment to the fullest, that's the only way to really live. And so that's what made me want to write a musical about her.
You talked a little bit about your own experience converting to Catholicism. And I'm thinking about Sister Thea. They're living in Canton, Mississippi as a child in a Methodist family, converting to Catholicism, and what that experience must have been like, because as you probably know from reading about her, in Canton, Mississippi, it is a strange thing indeed to be Catholic anyway, much less yeah. an African American Catholic. What is it about the Catholic tradition that how did Sister Thea become how did Bertha Bowman, Bertie Bowman as she would have been called then, become familiar with the Catholic Church?
It was her experience with the Franciscan Sisters of Perpetual Adoration that ran the Holy Child Jesus Mission School. It was seeing them and having watching them and observing and experiencing how they dealt with the children there in Canton, Mississippi, and seeing all of this love lavished on them. And that's what she said, I want to love like that. I want to serve like that. So it was really the witness, the personal witness. And I don't think those sisters were in any way trying to convert any of the children. They were there to serve the educational needs of a population that was just discarded and ignored. And here they were, just out of a great sense of love and mission, they took care and treated these children like their own. And I think that kind of witness is what led her to say, you know what, this is it. And she loved it all. She said, we love the incense and the rosaries and the preaching. She names it all. And she said, we loved it all. And the most powerful witness to her was the love that she experienced. And you have to remember, this was a time before civil rights. This was when segregated schools, and even when, you know, the schools were supposed to become desegregated, they were separate and definitely not equal. And she came from, and Mississippi has always been on the bottom rung in terms of economy, in terms of their economy, when you look at all 50 states. And so she was just very moved by the love and the witness of the Franciscan Sisters of Perpetual Adoration. And that's what led her to want to be, I'm going to be one of them, you know, so I thought that was very powerful.
Sister Laura Nettles is with us as well, and we're talking about Sister Thea Bowman, who's the anniversary of her passing is this week, and so, you know, in that context, you're thinking about what a great life and the influence that she still has. She's unique among not only American Catholics, but Catholics with any connection to the La Crosse area in that there's now a case going on for which supporters hope will eventually lead to her canonization. And she's now designated as Servant of God, Sister Thea Bowman, which is kind of, as I understand it, not being Catholic, that's like the first step in that process. How long does a process like that usually take, Sister Laura?
There are four steps in the process, but each step can take years and years to happen. I always like to share with my students that the Catholic Church does not move quickly on anything. So it's going to be years, I think, before we see Thea as a saint. But we keep praying, and we have great hope that she will one day be declared a saint. She's a saint in our hearts for sure.
As a member of the same order that she belonged to, what's it like when you reflect on sort of the principles that she lived out and compare that to the work that the sisters do now and how one informs the other. I mean, obviously her role as becoming a member of the Franciscan Sisters of Perpetual Adoration informed her activities for the rest of her life. And now her legacy is informing some of the work that you're doing.
Absolutely. Well, I appreciate Valamar's statement that, you know, she was really about love, and she experienced that love with FSBA, right? That was her first, I think, real taste of the gospel-centered love that we are all called to. And so we certainly continue that as FSBA. But I have to tell you, Thea experienced some difficulties when she came to La Crosse. She experienced racism right here in La Crosse at our own university, and most likely within her own community. And so if we're really going to be about that gospel love, Thea stands as a beacon and a reminder that we have to do the work of being anti-racist, right? We have to do the work of being inclusive and spreading that love. So it's kind of a circle, right? In a sense that it's from love that we first encountered Thea, but it's Thea's continued presence among us that reminds us that we have to share that love and we have to spread it further than I think we thought we needed to at some point.
Valimar, I saw you nodding your head when Sister Laura mentioned some of the racism that that Sister Thea experienced when she first moved north. We talk about Mississippi and other parts of the Deep South as though racism is a unique product of that area, but that's not the case at all, is it?
It is not. And I mean, if you read some of the Pew Research and other wonderful organizations that do research, for a while, the state of Wisconsin was actually one of the worst states in the union in which a Black person could live. So the reality of racism and its existence, it's pervasive and it happens in every state of the union. And that was one of the things that in the show, you will see the show that I wrote about her life, that hurt her very deeply. I think she had this great experience. Remember, she was very young. She was, only 15 when she went to La Crosse. So she was very young and very inexperienced in that she lived in a very homogenous community. She had only seen Black people. These white sisters and fathers that were coming to as a part of this mission school were some of the first white people she had ever encountered. And so that first encounter was all about love and spreading the gospel. And then she goes to La Crosse and she experiences, white people who are not like the people that she had grown to love and become enamored with and wanting to emulate. She goes to a place where she's experiencing the racism and she talks very much about her experience of racism in Mississippi, which was a lot more more violent in a sense, but the covert racism is just as hurtful, just as damaging to the spirit. And so she talks about the covert and overt racism she experienced in La Crosse. And again, this was some of the first entree, the first Black person a lot of people in La Crosse will have actually seen in the flesh. You see them on television, but to see them in the flesh. And when she talks about some of those experiences, it reminds me of my own experience. I did the European premiere of Raisin, which is based on A Raisin in the Sun. And we did it in a small town in St. Gallen, Switzerland. And here we were, they came and cast, an Austrian producer came to Howard University and cast the show so they could have cheap labor, right? And so I got the part of Benita. So we went to this small town. And when we all decided, well, let's walk to the first rehearsal, and we were started walking, buses stopped. People got out of trams. People came out of stores because it was the first time they actually saw a Black person in the flesh, not on television. So I can, when Sister Thea describes these experiences that she had when she went to La Crosse, I really understood them so deeply because they kind of were, matched my own experience with that. So racism is here, and it's something that we have to face with what we know we are supposed to be living in terms of the gospel. So I absolutely agree with Sister.
When you look at the experiences with racism that Thea Bowman dealt with in La Crosse, since that's where we are, I mean, it's you talked about the difference between that, what some people might think is more subtle, but still is very pervasive, racism that isn't Jim Crow, but it still is discriminatory. But you compare that with what you have gone through in your own life. Like what are the similarities there, and what needs to still change to move people past that, or to for us as a society to take the next step in progressing away from that?
I loved how Sister Thea was not, she didn't believe, I, from all of my readings, everything that I've studied about her life, she wasn't trying to get everyone to be the same. It's not about sameness. It's about celebrating, accepting, celebrating, and honoring, appreciating our differences. And I think once we do that, we get rid of this idea of you're different than I am, and this group of us that are different, we're better than that group of you over there. You know, so I loved how she really, Sister Thea Bowman, encouraged everyone to fully embrace their own culture and to be open to love, to embrace and appreciate everyone else's culture. And I think that's part of the issue. I mean, if we wanted to take a walk through a botanical garden, we wouldn't want to look at all roses. We wouldn't want to look at all chrysanthemums. You know, it's the beauty of that God has created that Sister Thea continually talked about. The beauty is in our differences. And the unity, the thing that binds us together is love. She would say that it's love, it's love. The gospel talks about love. It's love, the love of those Franciscan Sisters of Perpetual Adoration that had her want to convert, and I'm going to the mother house, and I'm going to, you know, she told her parents didn't want her to go. And she said, well, I'm going. She even went on a hunger strike until her parents said, okay.
A hunger strike.
Wait, yes, she did. Until her parents agreed to let her go. You know, so it's that love that drew her. And what can we do to actually counter racism? There's so many books out there. There's so many things we can do. But I think for us who believe in the power of love, the power of God, God is love. That love, if we could learn to embrace, not tolerate one another, not tolerate. It's not about tolerating. It's about appreciating, accepting, appreciating our differences and valuing them as something that's fantastic, not something that is pejorative, but our differences, the differences that we are, our diversity. If we can find unity in our diversity, and that thing that can unite us is love.
Valimar Jansen is the actor portraying Sister Thea Bowman in a new one-woman musical called Sister Thea Bowman, I Will Live Until I Die. And we will tell you how you can take part and see that musical in La Crosse next week. Also joining us today, Sister Laura Nettles, who is Assistant Professor of Religious Studies at Viterbo University. And our conversation will continue in just a moment. Remember, we always want to hear from you. You can email us, newsmakers@wpr.org. That's newsmakers@wpr.org. Our conversation, as I said, continues in just a moment. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Ezra Wall from our Southwest Wisconsin Bureau. We're talking today about Sister Thea Bowman, her life and her legacy, and some new ways that she's being honored in our community today on Newsmakers. Joining us are singer, composer, performing, and recording artist Valimar Jansen, who is appearing in a musical next week here in La Crosse, all about Sister Thea. Joining us as well, Sister Laura Nettles, the Executive Director for Mission and Social Justice at Viterbo University and Assistant Professor of Religious Studies there as well. I want to talk about the Sister Thea Bowman Center, which is there on the campus at Viterbo University. You talked about Sister Laura in our first segment. You talked about the trajectory of Sister Thea's work being really about inclusivity across the board, and about finding ways that all people can feel welcome there. How do you hope to continue that kind of work there at Viterbo?
So the great part about the center is that we're going to be able to host a number of student fellows. We're going to call them Sister Thea Bowman Fellows. And what we know is that if we can empower our students to be change makers in the world, that's exactly what they're going to do. So the scholars will be selected. They will receive a certain scholarship to be able to do this. So they'll actually get some funding for it. And then we're going to ask them to do research and provide them the tools to do the research about variety of social justice projects and issues. And to connect it to the last segment, we're really starting with work on racism. Because again, to truly honor Thea is to do the work of being anti-racist.
Thea Bowman grew up in Mississippi, came to Wisconsin as a teenager, as a brand new person involved in the Franciscan Sisters of Perpetual Adoration. But growing up in the South and growing up among Black Southerners as she did, she would have been absolutely steeped in the music of that tradition. And having read and learned a little bit about Sister Thea throughout my life, I know that that was very important for her. And Valamar, I know as a musician, it's also very important for you. Tell me about the musical heritage that Thea Bowman brought with her into her Catholicism and how that played a role in her life.
Well, she, of course, brought the music of the Black church into her Catholicism. And one of the things that she taught was to be, you know, authentically, truly Black and truly Catholic at the same time. So be true to your culture as well as true to Catholicism. So one of the things that I love and one of the things that I've based the show on is the fact that Sister Thea used spirituals a lot. She loved the spirituals. She called herself an old folks child. And she was an old folks child because of the age of her parents when she was born. But she was also an old folks child because her parents kept her in the company of older people. And so she would hear the wisdom and the songs, the old songs, you know, like, oh, freedom, and give me that old time religion. You know, so she had all these beautiful spirituals that kind of inundated her, and they were infused through her whole system. So that's what I do with the play is I use spirituals the way that Sister Thea did.
Sister Laura, thinking about what Valamar was just saying about being authentically Black and authentically Catholic for someone like Sister Thea, that's one of those things that a worldwide organization like the Catholic Church has had to overcome. Is this sort of Eurocentric aspect of it, and we're talking about things like inclusion and all those kinds of things. Well, part of that inclusion is. Part of that inclusion is like things that we would think of as cultural, like food or like music or things like that. Especially music. People can be pretty picky when it comes to music in religious settings. What do you think someone like Sister Thea kind of brought to that effort within your own community at the Franciscan Sisters of Perpetual Adoration?
You know, music is more than just music. It conveys our spirituality. It conveys our theology. And for so many years, we have made theology really, as you said, Eurocentric, right? That we focus on just one element of theology. And I think the biggest contribution that Thea brought is to say that people's lived experiences, really, when you get into the root of the spirituals, right? It's about people's experiences with the divine and the world that they were trying to make sense of. Thea brings that theology into the church in a really vibrant way that I really hope our church is listening to. Because that theology has been with us for years. We just haven't been willing to listen to it. I think of the classic story of Thea in front of the U.S. Catholic bishops, when she goes to speak to the bishops and she has them link arm in arm. She was teaching them. She was helping them understand that theology has roots in all different places. And if we're truly going to be inclusive, then we have to remember the experiences of everyone and how they convey those experiences theologically.
We look at a lot of the voices that are looking for representation, whether it's specifically within Catholic circles or just more broadly in our society right now. And the example of Sister Thea in that setting before the U.S. Catholic bishops kind of comes to mind, or there are lessons to be learned there, because here she is, a person who, in front of very powerful people, demonstrating to them something different than what they're used to experiencing, and saying, "Hey, you—I mean, very kindly and welcomingly, but saying, "Hey, you need to pay more attention to this." And those are the kinds of things that we see now with people from all kinds of different walks of life, racial differences or gender disparity or LGBTQ plus issues and all kinds of things, people trying to bring those notions to folks that have more power in society. What do you think people in that kind of fight can learn from someone like Sister Thea's example?
I think they found encouragement.
Yes.
To be truly who they are and to have the courage and wisdom to speak out. What do you think, Valdemar?
I believe that if we go back and look at that transcript, June 1989, we will find that Sister Thea, she laid down absolute steps that the bishops could take to do some of the work of anti-racism. She actually were telling them, this is what you can do to teach people to be anti-racist. And if you go back and really just dissect that speech that she made, it's amazing. It's prophetic. I mean, she was a prophet speaking what a lot of people are actually saying right now. And some of those very steps that she laid out for the bishops at that time are steps that people are starting to take right now. So she was well before her time. And if we go back and listen to her words and take heart and really follow those little pebbles, those steps that she laid down, the step right here, the step right, then we would be far, much farther down the road in terms of Roman Catholics doing the work of anti-racism.
Valdemar, I want to talk about this show. We've been teasing the important details. I want to tell people about where they can see your show, and it's called Sister Thea Bowman, I Will Live Until I Die, and it's going to be performed at the San Damiano Chapel on the campus of Viterbo University Tuesday the 5th. That's this coming Tuesday at 7 p.m. The good news is you don't need any tickets or anything. All you got to do is show up at San Damiano on the campus of Viterbo, and you get to see it. But Valdemar, tell me about this show. It's a one-woman show about Sister Thea Bowman. So tell me how you accomplish that. What are people going to experience when they come?
This is for this year. Next year it's going to be a full musical with a huge cast, performing cast. This is my introduction to let people know that it's going to, you know, that it exists. And I'm doing it as a stage reading, as a one-woman musical, and the characters come alive. Sister Thea comes alive, hopefully, through my performance. So it's one that I don't think you'll want to miss. There will be some musicians and a choir there assisting. But next year, when we do it for the week of Sister Thea Bowman's celebration, it'll be a big full cast of about 30 people. So for now, it's just going to be myself and a choir and to introduce the play to everyone.
And you and I were chatting before we began our interview. So to kind of introduce the different biographical elements along the way, you're doing it as though Sister Thea is at like a book signing or a live book reading.
Right.
That's the mechanism.
You're right. It's a book signing, and she's there to read portions of her book and to bring the characters of the book alive. So yeah, that's the setting of the play.
That sounds very interesting, and I can't wait to see it on Tuesday the 5th, this upcoming Tuesday at 7 p.m. At Viterbo University. Sister Laura, before we go, I want to give you a chance to tell people where they can find more information about the Sister Thea Bowman Center at Viterbo.
Excellent. So if you go to our website, viterbo.edu/Sister Thea Bowman, you can find out there's a number of resources there. If you want to learn more about her, you can click on different performances. We are currently celebrating Thea Bowman Week here on our campus. So we've recorded a number of our events. You can go back and watch some of the various events and check us out and follow our students and their work.
So that's all at viterbo.edu/Sister Thea Bowman.
Correct.
All right. Sister Laura Nettles has been one of our guests today. Sister Laura is the Executive Director for Mission and Social Justice and Assistant Professor of Religious Studies at Viterbo University. Sister Laura, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much for letting us talk about Thea.
Certainly. Valimar Jansen is a singer and composer and performer and just a really dynamic artist who is behind the musical Sister Thea Bowman, I Will Live Until I Die, which will be staged at San Damiano Chapel on Tuesday. Valimar, thank you very much for being on Newsmakers today.
Thank you so much for having me, and I'm thrilled and honored to be doing this for Sister Thea.
Thank you very much. Coming up, find out what's going on this spring at the National Eagle Center in Wabasha, Minnesota. Remember, you can hear this conversation again or stream any of our previous episodes on demand. Just go to WPR.org/newsmakers. That's WPR.org/newsmakers. We are back in just a minute. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. From Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in our Southwest studios. The bald eagle, its symbolism in the United States is unmistakable, and so too is its majesty in nature. And today on Newsmakers, we're hearing more about a place in our listening area where you can learn about America's most famous raptor. And joining us is Ed Hahn, Marketing Director at the National Eagle Center in Wabasha, Minnesota, to talk about spring programs and much more that's going on at the center. Ed, welcome back to Newsmakers.
Thank you, Ezra. It's a pleasure to be here today.
So we're talking all about the bald eagle, and I know you've got April and May programs that you want to talk about, but also we've kind of just come out of like what you call peak viewing season for bald eagle activity, like around the river and whatnot. So talk about people might assume that if they've missed the peak viewing season, that there isn't much left to see. Talk about what is interesting and available about eagles and habitat and everything coming in the spring.
Well, you know, living in along the upper Mississippi River Valley, we are absolutely spoiled when it comes to kind of the natural splendor and beauty and wonders. And certainly the wildlife that we have, including bald eagles, is no exception to that. And you're absolutely right. This particular winter that we're getting out of now was just a banner year for bald eagle viewing. Here at the center, the National Eagle Center here in Wabasha, we actually do through the months of December through March, we do a weekly bald eagle count, and that we have about 7 locations where various volunteers and staff go out between the south end of Red Wing, Minnesota, down to just north of Winona. And every Friday, we just kind of do a snapshot in time count to let people know what the bald eagle activity is like. And this year was absolutely incredible. It was the highest average weekly count we've had in the last 7 years when I went back and crunched those numbers. So it was just a wonderful winter to get out if people were able to do it and take in bald eagles, you know, see them sitting in the trees, watch them soaring high above. They're an American icon, obviously, our national symbol, and just awesome raptors. And they have a universal appeal. So people get really excited to see them. And we're spoiled in this part of the country for sure.
This weekend marks the first weekend in April. You have weekend programs in April and May this spring at the Eagle Center. Tell me what goes on at these weekend programs.
Yeah, well, we're really excited to announce them and be hosting them again because we are currently in the midst of our phase one of our major expansion and renovation here at the National Eagle Center. We've actually been closed to the public since the start of November of last year. And so people have not been able to come the past several months and visit us and visit the Eagle ambassadors and take in our programs and all that. So we've finished some of our temporary renovations. And so we have a new program center right along Main Street here in downtown Wabasha. And we will be inviting people back and inviting them in to take in our programs once again on the weekends, Fridays through Sundays, each weekend here in April and May. So we're very excited to do that. And those programs are very popular with our audience. We get lots of people every year who have seen it multiple times. And, you know, they come back with different friends, different family. People love it, but it's a great way to learn about Eagles. It's a great way to interact with our educators. And, you know, I think every time someone goes to one of our educational programs, it doesn't matter how many times you've seen one, you're probably going to learn something new. So we're excited to be able to welcome people back because we haven't been able to for the past several months. And it's kind of a soft reopening for us as we prepare to open again to daily visitors later this spring.
So in terms of what happens at the programs, it's an indoor program. So it's no matter what the weather is, the program is still going to happen?
Correct. Yep. So they're indoor programs. And basically, you know, it starts out kind of as a not a lecture per se, but it's a presentation by our expert naturalists and eagle experts. A lot of Q&A. There's some audience participation elements, which makes it fun for audiences of all ages, keeps it engaging. And then, of course, the highlight for a lot of people is that at the very end of those programs, they bring in one of the Eagle ambassadors, one of our live Eagle ambassadors, and they get to see that bird up close on the handler's glove. And it's a wonderful photo opportunity for people. Usually they're feeding the eagles their lunch. And so people get a real kick out of that, being able to see that up close and personal. So yeah, they're beloved. You know, our programs have always been a big draw for us. People, like I said, come back year after year to see those programs. And it's a great way for them to, again, meet the live Eagle ambassadors of the National Eagle Center up close.
How many Eagle ambassadors do you have now?
Currently, we have four Eagle ambassadors. We have two females and two males of various ages. It used to be a little more varied. Unfortunately, we had our beloved Golden Eagle ambassador, Donald. He passed away right after COVID, actually. He was an extremely old bird. He was probably in his early 30s. We don't know for sure. But so at one point, you know, for many, many years, we had ambassadors that represented both of the native eagle species we have here in North America. So today, well, we just have the bald eagle ambassadors, but again, they're great. People love them, you know, as well. Latch is our youngest eagle ambassador. He's 5 years old this year. He's actually a local boy. He was hatched and raised and rescued on an island just outside of Winona, Minnesota. So that's halfway between La Crosse and Wabasha. So he's our newest rock star ambassador. He does a lot of programmings, but it's really nice to be able to have that local connection as well.
You talked about the two different kinds of eagles, the golden eagles and the bald eagles. And I don't know anything about eagles, but one of the very few things that I do know is that I was looking around when I first moved back to town a couple of years ago, and I'd see eagles flying, and I would see some and assume, oh, these are golden eagles because they don't look like bald eagles. But that's not always the case, is it?
No, it is not always the case, but you raise a really, I would say, probably one of the most common areas of question that we get. We get a lot of visitors or followers online that share their stories, and especially when they, you know, when we still had our Golden Eagle Ambassador, Donald, but even during the winter when Golden Eagles are in this part of the country, people get really excited about that. And, you know, there's plenty of people who have never seen a wild Golden Eagle because, you know, they're not as prevalent in this part of North America as they are, say, out west or even further north of us. But you're absolutely correct. They're frequently confused for each other because juvenile bald eagles are mostly brown. They don't get that iconic white head and tail until they are fully mature. And that can happen anywhere, depending on the individual, between 4 and 6 years of age. And so a lot of times what people are seeing out here in this part of the country, especially if you're in the river valley, you see those big dark birds, you're thinking, oh my gosh, that's a golden eagle. And there's different ways to distinguish between balds and goldens. The key thing to remember, at least in this part of the United States and North America, is that golden eagles really are only here in the winter months. And typically that's from about late November into maybe early to mid-March. So right now we're definitely at the tail end of golden eagle season. We just had a field trip experience last weekend where the group was fortunate enough to get two sightings of two juvenile golden eagles, but we certainly weren't expecting that. So it was a pleasant surprise. The other thing to keep in mind, especially, year round, is if you're seeing a big brown bird and it's over the river or it's over a lake, it is probably a bald eagle and it's probably a juvenile bald eagle. And the difference there is that bald eagles are water birds. They live and nest near water because their primary food source is fish. And golden eagles are more terrestrial upland predators. So you're going to find them more in dry areas away from large bodies of water, which is why you find them very commonly out in the western United States, in the Mountain West, the desert Southwest. And we know through research and satellite tracking that the golden eagle population that we have here during the winter months is actually coming here to our valleys and coulees from about 2,000 miles north. That's where their nesting territory is, just south of the Arctic Circle.
Wow.
So they make one heck of a migration each year, but they are certainly visitors and not residents of this part of North America.
Speaking of the habitat that these birds thrive in, what are some things that people need to look out for in terms of threats to these creatures or the places that they live?
Yeah, well, I guess I would start by just looking at the history of bald eagles in North America. We all know that at one point they were critically endangered. In the later part of the 20th century. And we know that that was primarily due to DDT, which was a very widely used insecticide. It was very good at its job, but unfortunately it had a side effect that impacted eagles and caused their population to crash. Now, what's interesting about that story is that a lot of people, when they hear that, they think, oh, DDT was sprayed into the environment and, the eagles either ingested it or inhaled it and it poisoned them and they died. That actually wasn't the case. What happened was, is that it became a calcium uptake inhibitor in bald eagles. And if you're going to be laying eggs in the spring, you have to have calcium in your diet in order to create those eggs. And under normal conditions, eagle eggs they're actually very strong structures. We will do egg crushing demonstrations with chicken eggs here at the center occasionally, and people are amazed at how much weight an egg can actually hold before it crushes. And bald eagles don't actually weigh all that much. A typical female in this part of the country might weigh 10 or 11 pounds, but the calcium in their diet, the DDT that was in their system and in the environment was preventing them from uptaking that in their diet. And so they were laying eggs that were so thin-shelled that they would crush them under their own weight.
Mm.
And so the problem there was that people didn't realize that bald eagles were being impacted until years after this damage had been done, because essentially they weren't, renewing their population. But bald eagles in the wild, they'll live 20 to 25 years. So, you're looking at almost a decade, maybe two decades before people realize, wait a second, how come there's no bald eagles anymore? So we came very close to losing them. That said, you know, one of the ongoing threats to bald eagles is lead in the environment. And people often wonder, well, how is lead getting into bald eagles? This has actually been in the news recently. There's been plenty of surveys and studies done throughout North America that's showing that most bald eagles that they sampled showed trace amounts of lead in their system. And lead is a neurotoxin. It causes a very slow, agonizing death for bald eagles. And it only takes about 85 milligrams to fatally poison a bald eagle. Now, to put that in perspective, what the example we use here at the center is that if you take a penny out of your pocket and you look at the nose on Abe Lincoln's face, that's about the size of a fragment of lead that could fatally poison an eagle.
That is almost nothing.
That's almost nothing. Again, about 85 milligrams. Now, how are they getting it? Well, a lot of hunters will tell you and are aware that, you know, for waterfowl hunting now, in most places, lead ammunition is banned. But where lead ammunition is not banned and still widely used is for deer hunting. And what we know is that lead is a softer metal. And so when you're deer hunting and you fire that bullet and the bullet strikes the harder tissues of the deer, like the cartilage or the bone, it fragments into all these tiny little pieces. Then if you're the hunter, obviously you go and you harvest your deer, you're going to field dress it, and the gut pile is going to be left behind. And, you know, most hunters are thinking, oh, I'm just going to leave this out here because, you know, the coyote or the wolf or the birds are going to come by and they're going to eat it. And so that, you know, they're not intending any harm. They think they're doing a good thing. Mm-hmm. But a lot of times there are tiny lead fragments in that gut pile. And bald eagles are scavengers as well as hunters. So they see that gut pile, they're going to go down there. That's easy food. They're going to eat it. And suddenly they're ingesting those lead fragments.
Wow.
And it proves fatal for a lot of eagles.
You talked about how your center is going through this amazing expansion, remodeling, that kind of thing. How long is that expected to take? When do you anticipate the rest of your facility, or at least portions of your facility, to be available to the public again?
Yeah, so it's a pretty dramatic renovation of the building that people would be familiar with, and that's our main building right on the riverfront here in Wabasha. But we are anticipating or planning to reopen to daily visitors later on this spring, so probably in late May is what it's looking like right now.
Okay, and in the meantime, I was looking at your website in preparation for this interview, and it looks like there's a lot that is available there. I know you've got a YouTube page and some of those other online offerings. What can people find if they visit your website?
Yeah, so we're actually going to be launching a new website here as we reopen to the public as well, so people can keep a lookout for that here in the next couple of months. But yeah, you're absolutely right. We're on social media. We are online. One of the best places to connect with the National Eagle Center is on our Facebook page. Just go on to Facebook and search National Eagle Center. We do Facebook Live videos on there. We typically do daily educational posts. We share photos that different users and followers submit to us. So it's just a great way to, you know, if you're a lover of eagles, it's a great way to learn more about them or maybe just see cool pictures of them. But we have a really good community there and it continues to grow and we're excited to engage with our community out there. Like you said, we're also on YouTube. We have videos on there as well. And we also have an Instagram account as well. So there's multiple ways that people can connect with us. And of course, if you go to the website, which is nationaleaglecenter.org, you can click the link to go to the Eagle Watch Cam, which is a webcam that's mounted right on our facility and it overlooks the Mississippi River right outside our back door. And there's typically eagles soaring around out there, maybe catching fish or maybe just perched in the trees, but we have that camera on all day, every day. So it's a good way just to kind of check in and see what's happening out there in the heart of eagle territory.
And is that website where people is the best place for people to find more information about the spring programs that we talked about earlier that are going weekends in April and May?
Yeah, absolutely. So seating is going to be limited in our program center, and we know demand is high. So we are going to require moving forward that people reserve their seats for those programs in advance, and people can go to the website. There's two links on there. You can go to that page and you can basically select the date and you can select the program time, and then it'll take you to a form. You can do all of your pre-registration online, and then away you go. All you have to do is show up at the day and time, give us your name, and we'll check you in, and you can enjoy the program.
And that's at nationaleaglecenter.org.
Yep, that is nationaleaglecenter.org, and then the page is /reservation.
Ed Hahn is the marketing director at the National Eagle Center in Wabasha, Minnesota. Ed, thanks a lot for being here on Newsmakers.
It is my absolute pleasure, Ezra. Thanks for having me.
Indeed so. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's how you can listen to our program every week. We're on Friday morning at 10 on the Ideas Network, 90.3, and then Friday night at 7 on NPR News and Music, 88.9. And of course, we're always online at WPR.org/newsmakers. For Dawn Jewell, our producer, I'm Ezra Wall. Join us again next time for another Newsmakers, right here from Wisconsin Public Radio.